WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Natalie Moore, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. It's time to catch up on the latest across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap, where we take you behind the headlines. From the sentencing of former Alderman Ed Burke fast approaching.
Federal prosecutors want former Chicago Alderman Ed Burke locked away for a decade.
To a controversial music fest moving out of the city.
The founder of Riot Fest making the big announcement that this year's festival will be moving out of Douglas Park after 9 years to SeatGeek Stadium in Bridgeview.
There's a lot to dive into, and I couldn't do it alone. This week's panel was Heather Sharon, Chicago politics reporter for WTTW, Greg Hines, political columnist for Crane's Chicago Business, and joining us later in the conversation, Salem Kolo Julin, editor-in-chief of the Chicago Reader. It's been a busy week for the City Council. Before we talked about the ordinances that got approved, I asked the panel for their thoughts on 42nd Ward Alderman Brendan Riley's Wednesday morning tweet, quote, "So, City Council is supposed to start promptly at 10 a.m. For the fourth meeting in a row, we are starting late waiting on the mayor. I'm guessing being stuck in hair and makeup is to blame." Here's Heather's reaction.
Well, of course, this is about the story by my colleagues over at the Chicago Sun-Times that showed that Brandon Johnson spent about $30,000 over the course of a year on hair and makeup services. And I think this is an emblematic tweet of how, or post, I should say, I guess, about how Brendan Riley has been conducting himself on social media, very rarely sort of missing an opportunity to either needle the mayor or to needle his sort of opponents. And this week I got caught in the crossfire a little bit. I had written a story about how the number of unhoused Chicagoans has tripled in the past year and to about 18,000 people who are either unsheltered on the city streets or living in city shelters. And he sort of, you know, shared my article and said this was evidence that the people behind Bring Chicago Home and the Chicago Coalition of the Homeless had been sort of juking the stats, so to speak, behind Chicago's unhoused population, that there aren't really almost 70,000 unhoused Chicagoans. But that includes people who are living doubled up with friends and relatives and sort of don't have a permanent place to live. And this is sort of a fundamental divide on how people sort of define what it means to be unhoused. That nuance sort of gets lost on social media.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that an older person who, you know, is sort of decades long in politics is sort of using social media, not just to punch at the mayor, but to punch at sort of people over policy disputes. And I think it's an interesting question about whether that's a good thing for Chicago politics or a not great thing.
I'm curious, did you respond to his tweet?
I did. And I sort of said, gee, thanks for sharing. I appreciate it. But here's what the dispute is. And I think this is sort of the fundamental question that the city has to figure out. How are we going to address our unhoused population? What does the city owe to those people? And how can we help the most number of people in the most effective way with tax dollars? So, you know, it's never a good idea to be going back and forth on social media.
Yeah.
We have all learned that.
Yes, we all have. Often the hard way.
Yes. But I did think it was important to say that this is not a question of sort of, you know, somebody being, you know, sort of, you know, loose with the facts. This is just a fundamental policy decision.
Greg, I want to go back to the hair and makeup. What are your thoughts about the mayor of the third largest city spending that kind of money?
Well, we all want to look good, particularly in public life. We're on radio, so you can't tell this, but you could spend $35,000 on my hair and it wouldn't do any good because there is none. But, you know, all's fair in love, war, and politics. When somebody spends that much money, one columnist figured it out as something like $80 a day, you're going to open yourself up to attack because, what, $35,000 a year is more than a good many Chicagoans make all year for everything, to feed themselves and their family and pay the rent and buy gasoline and whatever. I understand why the mayor wants to do it, but he kind of stumbled into this one, and you get the benefit from looking good. You also get the criticism from spending the money.
And just so listeners are clear, this was not taxpayer money.
No, this was contributions from public-minded citizens who want the mayor to do well, and in some cases want something from the mayor.
And that's a really good point, Natalie, because state law is clear that this is an appropriate use of campaign funds. In Illinois, there is very little restriction on how you can spend cash that you raise for your campaign. But I think the other question is Brandon Johnson is sort of the first mayor who has become mayor without being sort of independently or, you know, having family wealth. And this is the sort of expense and cost that somebody like J.B. Pritzker, a literal billionaire, can sort of cover without blinking an eye at it. And even Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who was a partner at Mayor Brown, you know, she is also very wealthy. Brandon Johnson does not come from that kind of family. He does not have that sort of backstop to sort of make sure that this doesn't become a public issue. And I think it raises a question if we're sort of focusing on the razzle dazzle of all of this. What are we telling people who are working class or who are lower middle class? Well, don't even try to run for office because we're going to make fun of you for sort of doing your best to sort of stay within the law and to use your resources to put forward your best face. I have real questions about that.
Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's smart politics or good policy. Yes, Mr. Johnson didn't have the kind of money, despite the Chicago Teachers Union, that other candidates have had. But when he chooses to spend that much money, it's going to draw attention. Nobody's claiming this is illegal, but there have been lots of instances in Chicago's famed, storied political past about big politicians spending lots of money out of their campaign fund on personal stuff. Dan Rostenkowski did it, for instance. They actually changed the law to require that at a certain point you have to declare income tax on it. So, no, it's not illegal. Yeah, he comes from humble roots. Is it smart politics? Questionable.
I just think it's interesting that this is what we're talking about when Ed Burke has spent literally $4 million of campaign cash on his federal criminal defense. And he has another $8 million, give or take, left that he can spend on sort of all of his appeals that I'm sure are coming. I just think it's a question of, you know, are we covering this in a way that is proportionate and sort of responsible and focused on the serious issues facing the
city? Ed Burke is a former public official. Brandon Johnson is the current mayor of Chicago.
Oh, sure. I'm just saying, if we're talking about $30,000.
Well, $30 versus $4 million. I think that there is something to be said to that. But Heather, let's talk about Alders approved a large police misconduct settlement. What are the details on that?
So $50 million will go to four men who became known as the Marquette Park Four. They were convicted wrongfully in 1995 of a double murder. The only evidence against those four teenagers back in the mid-90s, which I don't mean to call you out, Natalie, but I think we were in high school at the time, was the coerced confessions that they gave to two detectives who had been trained by former Chicago Police Commander John Burge, who, of course, as we know, tortured hundreds of black men to elicit wrongful confessions. All four men have been declared innocent by an Illinois judge. And this is, in some respects, one of the largest police misconduct settlements ever approved by the city council. About $21 million will come from taxpayers. Another $29 million will come from the city's insurance company. And I think it's really evidence that the city, in some ways, has really failed to grapple with the legacy left by John Burge and sort of his continuing sort of legacy in the department with training detectives who then train detectives. And again, we're in a situation where the city has complied with only 7% of the federal court order known as the consent decree that requires sort of reform and cultural change. The fact that this is just one of more than 50 police misconduct settlements the city has already settled this year just in 2024, I think gives me real questions about the police department's commitment to reform and its ability to reform.
Although I have to say, Heather, I probably don't need to say this, but I was in college when that happened, not in high school. Very early college. Greg, do you think this will have any impact on calls for police reform?
You know, hope springs eternal. This kind of thing has been haunting Chicago for decades. People want to know why we have a crime problem in Chicago. Part of the reason is there's lots of bad guys. We can argue about whether we have a good state's attorney or not. But clearly one of the reasons why we have a crime problem is that much of the city doesn't trust the police. And why do they not trust the police? Because of instances like this, where not only did they not catch the guys who did it, but they coerced and tortured a confession out of some people and then took 30 years out of their lives, or 25 years, whatever it was. At least we're talking about it. There's lots of stuff in the consent decree that was signed under Rahm Emanuel that supposedly show a path out. But this question, walking the right balance between being aggressive but not too aggressive, enlisting the community but also going out and catching the bad guys, this is a real challenge for our new police chief, Larry Smalling. And, things like this don't help.
I want to jump ahead and talk about the 8 p.m. teen curfew idea. Heather, what happened with that?
Well, this stemmed from an incident in Streeterville where there was a couple that apparently was attacked on the street, not in sort of the early evening hours. And this was in the second ward, which is represented by Alderman Brian Hopkins, I should say. And he is the chair of the city's police and fire committee. And he suggested that the issue is that teens shouldn't be allowed on the streets after 8 p.m. Right now, the city on weekdays has a 10 p.m. curfew for those under 16 and under. And then it has a 10:30 p.m. curfew on the Friday and Saturday nights. And he says that should be sort of extended, essentially. He introduced that proposal at this week's city council meeting. It was promptly blocked from advancing by Alderman Andre Vasquez, and it is now in legislative limbo, where it will likely stay because the proposal does not enjoy the support of Mayor Brandon Johnson, who I think accurately pointed out that there's really no empirical evidence to prove that teen curfews reduces the rates of crime and violence, and that it adds to that sort of disproportionate contact between law enforcement and Black youth and Latino youth, leading to very severe consequences. So I think that this is another instance that we've seen time and time again where there's been some sort of violent incidents in areas of the city that are predominantly white and predominantly wealthy that gets an oversized reaction by the city's political leadership. And I think it raises real questions about the city's ability to sort of come up with crime prevention tools as opposed to law enforcement tools. And that's the big divide right now.
And those boundaries are roughly Division to the north, Halsted to the west, Roosevelt to the south, Lake Michigan to the east. And obviously, Alder Brian Hopkins was disappointed with this. Let's hear what he had to say about it.
Now what we're seeing is they're starting earlier, and the crimes that are happening earlier. And the police have asked me to do this because if they want to break up some of these gatherings, say on the beach, for example, they want to be able to do it before it gets to a crowd of 100.
And Mayor Johnson, as we said, did not agree with this. Let's hear why.
If a young person has to be accompanied by an adult, what is the definition of an adult? Is it an 18-year-old? Is it a 19-year-old? Is it a 21-year-old? These are just reasonable questions.
And Greg, you recently wrote that teen employment might be a key to reducing youth crimes. Talk about that.
What you're referencing is a study that indicated that in certain parts of Chicago, a very There's very high unemployment rates among young people. And a shockingly high figure, I don't have the numbers in front of me, are neither in school nor working. I mean, they're kind of hanging around. And, you know, you hang around when you're 16 or 17 or 18, you're going to get in trouble. Clearly, part of the solution to this problem is to provide alternatives, because most kids are basically good. They don't want to land up in jail or whatever. They don't want to embarrass their family. They want to, you know, make money and have a good life. But I'm not unsympathetic to Alderman Hopkins' concern here that you've had a whole series of instances where you, in effect, have a gang of kids shows up. They stay there well into the night. The guns come out. Some of my fondest memories of this city are the 4th of July. We used to have July 3rd fireworks.
I remember that. I was in high school then.
Downtown. You know, it was a wonderful event. It brought the entire city together, but we don't do it anymore. Why not? Because they're afraid that some jerk is going to take out a gang and a gun and shoot at another jerk. There's a core problem here. Clearly, lack of employment and alternates is part of it, but law enforcement has to be, I think, part of the problem, too.
But I think it's also telling kids, particularly, you know, black kids, the city's not yours. You are not welcome here.
That is a risk. It's like anything else. It's a balance. You know, 5 or 6 kids hanging around downstairs, downtown, going to the movie, going to the store, fine. But when you have 400 or 500 blocking the street and jumping up and down in cars, and that's happened repeatedly in recent years, that's not just enjoying the city.
Greg, I want to stay on city council for just a little bit more. 47th Ward Alder Matt Martin's ethics ordinance also stalled in city council. It would have restricted mayors from taking campaign donations from lobbyists. What happened?
What happened is it got deferred. The mayor made it clear he wants to hold this for release of a fuller ethics package. We can speculate as to whether that's real or whether the mayor just wants to is looking for an excuse to protect his campaign fundraising. The core concept here is that there's been a lot of instances of, look at the Ed Burke case, of lobbyists who've contributed money to people. Illegalities have occurred. So the question is, should you keep the money completely separate from the process? To the extent this is a good idea for mayors, which is the alderman's proposal, Mr. Johnson is right that, well, isn't it a good idea for alders too? You know, if there's a question about giving money and not accepting contributions to your political fund from registered lobbyists, shouldn't it apply to everybody who's in city government who's running for an office? That having been said, there are portions of this that perhaps go a little bit too far. For instance, any company that hired a lobbyist would also be directly prohibited from directly contributing to a campaign themselves. At a certain point, you do have free speech rights if you're a company to contribute. This is in that wonderful limbo we call the city council now. Whether it's going to make it out or not, we don't know. But the mayor seems to be rather insistent that, well, if you're going to do this, I want a whole package, and it's going to apply to you and not just me.
Well, let's hear what Mayor Johnson had to say.
You know, what we've said all along, that if you want to eliminate corruption in government, we certainly should work to make sure that rules apply to anyone who has been given the trust of the public.
We should make sure the rules apply to anyone. Where is he going with that, Greg?
Well, can you spell alder? it's pretty clear here. You want to pass a rule that affects me? Well, have it affect you too. He's very clearly saying that. You know, we'll see. Personally, in this town, any ethical improvement in my book is an improvement, even if it only applies to some of the people. But I understand where the mayor's coming from on this one.
Well, let's talk about the Southside Lakefront property, U.S. Steel, that this elusive piece of property that just can't seem to get developed. But, Greg, you wrote about that in your column this week.
Yeah, one of the underreported aspects of the Pritzker administration is that he has put a lot of money and effort into economic development, particularly emerging technologies, electric vehicles, batteries, and whatever. We've had some real success there. There's like 8,000 people working at the Rivian plant downstate. We have a big battery factory coming soon to the south suburbs. Stellantis is about to open a battery factory and electric vehicle factory up in the north suburbs in the next few years. Well, the next phase of that is something called quantum. Quantum is the next generation of computing. It makes the computers faster and able to handle problems that conventional computers do. And it does it by storing things not with electrons, but with literally little pieces of light, photons. Well, the governor had this proposal to, there's a company that wants to open a big photon center, essentially a big computer, supercomputer, either at the USX site or in Lockport in the southwest suburbs. Mayor Johnson, there were some questions out there about this mayor has other priorities. Is he going to get behind this? Well, I talked to his people and I talked to some other people, and he's all behind this one. he's making the argument that this could be billions of dollars of investment in jobs for a part of the city, the south and southeast sides, that have been terribly underinvested. And while, you know, maybe there are not a lot of quantum scientists on the south side, there are a lot of people who work in support functions, who would be working construction, whatever. This means jobs, it means money, it means investment. So he's all behind this, and we'll find out in a month or so when the company, it's called PsiQuantum, decides whether it's going to go to the USX property or go to Lockport.
But I'm curious, if nothing else had been able to be developed on that land because it can be remediated, what is it about quantum that says, yeah, we can do this now?
There's been all kinds of proposals through the years. A movie theater.
A second downtown.
A second downtown. Houses, factories, whatever. None of them have worked. This would start small. It wouldn't take up a lot of property. Much of the site has already been remediated. But they need kind of a big chunk of property, and this is a big chunk of property. It's like 70 acres. It needs access to water, and it needs access to a lot of energy, because you have to super cool this stuff for the computer to work, and that requires an awful lot of energy. And it's available. You know, if they want to do it and they think this is the right spot for them, and apparently they have some other companies that are interested in following along, like IBM, God bless. Nothing else has worked in this part of town. And I think the mayor deserves a pat on the back for getting behind this. It shows some real potential.
Heather, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there have been proposals after proposals to build housing on this site, and it's never been clear that this site will be able to meet the standards required by the EPA for residential occupation. But having sort of a commercial operation on this property means that they'll have to meet a lower standard of safety for this land. So it's one thing to have somebody living there 24/7. It's another thing to have people rotate in and out for 8-hour shifts. And I think that it's an acknowledgement that it is likely too costly, if it's at all possible, to remediate this land to where it can become homes, which means that you then have to think, well, what sort of commercial operations need this size property and sort of these large scale sort of so-called green operations is really sort of the last remaining possibility. But, you know, this is a part of sort of, you know, the you know, sort of Chicago that has been essentially completely unused since the steel mills left. But, and I think Greg is correct that if this comes to fruition, it's not only something that Brandon Johnson can tout in what I assume will be a very robust reelection campaign, but it's also something Governor J.B. Pritzker can use, you know, as he pursues his national political aspirations, to say, look, this has been sort of an albatross in Illinois, in Chicago, for 50 years, longer than that, and I fixed it. And that's what makes these sort of, you know, huge projects so attractive.
I still don't understand the remit. I mean, I get it that you're not living there, but this land has just seen so much over...
It sure has.
The past.
Well, you know, I asked a top city official about that, and he noted that part of it has been cleaned up enough that there's a park. With little
that is true. I mean, I love the park. We go there, but you're like, so, in it's less than an 8-hour shift.
So which goes to Heather's point about there's a difference between putting a factory there and living there. But the fact that they have a park there shows that it is possible. The question is how much it takes. In the new state budget, most people probably don't know this, Pritzker was able to get $500 million for a quantum campus, $300 million of which would be for site preparation. You want to talk about where the remediation comes from? Comes from that.
All right. Although right before the show, I got a press release from some neighbors, an environmental group, who have said, we have not been consulted on this. So we'll see
the devil is always
how that
in
plays
those
out
details.
Next week. Well, I want to go back to Ed Burke, Heather, Chicago's longest serving alder, now convicted felon. Federal prosecutors recommended what some saw as a pretty harsh sentence.
Well, they think he should go to prison for 10 years. And that is a not insignificant recommendation because Ed Burke is 80. And his family, in really sort of heartrending letters, told U.S. District Court Judge Virginia Kendall that if she accepts that recommendation, she is sentencing Ed Burke to die in prison, and that he is elderly and he is sick with a number of different health problems, and that he will simply not survive that stretch. On the other hand, federal prosecutors said that Ed Burke committed what they called a multi-year crime spree motivated only by greed, and that he deserves a significant prison stretch to send a message to other Chicago politicians who, as they said, might be tempted to walk what they called Ed Burke's dark path and to use their public office to bring in personal gain and money, as they say Ed Burke did, and as the jury found that he did. What's interesting is that in addition to sort of asking that Ed Burke not be sent to jail for any significant stretch of time, his lawyers submitted more than 200 letters from very high-profile Chicagoans asking that his sort of legacy of helping women and helping people with disabilities and of serving the city sort of ameliorate the harm that he did, according to the jury's verdict. What was interesting...
Although, Heather, who were some of the people who wrote letters?
Well, the only sitting member of the city council to write a letter was Alderman Nicholas Sposato, but there were other former aldermen, including Patrick O'Connor and Tom Allen and Terry Gabinski, whose daughter was actually part of one of the schemes that Ed Burke was convicted of. Dan Webb, who was a famous former prosecutor, he led the independent investigation into State's Attorney Kim Fox's handling of the Jussie Smollett case. He also said that he had never seen anything illegal from Ed Burke. There were also sort of famous people from, you know, the realm of the media. Bill Curtis, who I grew up watching on CBS2, wrote saying that Ed Burke was just the model of an alderman, which I think made a lot of people...
Really? Bill Curtis? I missed that one.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, there were also a number of officials with Misericordia and officials in the Catholic Church who said that, you know, who praised Ed Burke's deep Catholic faith along with his children and his wife, who, of course, is the former Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court.
Greg has his mock violin out. And, you know, Heather, you said that the feds are saying maybe this will deter people. Greg, there is no evidence that people do not commit crimes even after politicians go to prison. So what did you think of that 10-year sentence? And also, what do you think the judge is going to do?
Well, I have no idea what the judge is going to do. What I know is that the jury looked at all the facts and they said guilty. And in this country, you know, pending appeals, you go by what juries say. My favorite stories about Ed Burke, I heard this when I was a young reporter from a ranking city official, is about how one day he's chairing the finance committee, and there's a company that has a proposal up for a zoning or a bond issue or something, and you know, and he's life and death. What the chairman wants, the chairman's going to get. So during the proceedings, Alderman Burke goes behind the back into the city council antechamber, and he goes over to the lawyer for the applicant, and he hands him his business card. Lists his job as a property tax lawyer. And he says, just in case you need it. Now, how subtle is that? That's the kind of old style Chicago politics that Ed Burke represented. That you went into it not to serve the people, but to make a buck for yourself. I don't think that is nearly as raw and as clear now and as prevalent as it used to be 20 or 30 years ago. So all the prosecutions, I think, have had a little bit of an effect. Have we totally removed the problem? No, but if you don't lock up some people, you're not going to eliminate the problem. You're not going to cut back on the problem. The jury said he did it, and unless the appellate court says it, you know, he gets his sentence. If he did a few good things along the way in his 30 years as an alderman, great, but it doesn't forgive the bad stuff.
Well, you know, in the sentencing recommendation, the feds said that Ed Burke and his family have a wealth of $30 million, and that is a staggering amount.
$30 million,
because of course, when you sort of go through the pre-sentencing process, you have
a lot
to
of zoning
sort of,
work there.
You have to sort of declare all of your assets. And, Ed Burke for many years earned about $100,000 as a Chicago alderperson. And I think that it is a reasonable question to ask how he and his family amassed that kind of wealth. And I think it really also asks the question that if there were so many people who were willing to go on the record knowing that Greg and I and all of our colleagues were eagerly awaiting to see who wrote these letters, who publicly felt the need to thank Ed Burke for helping them or serving the city, doesn't that at least raise the argument that he still enjoys a significant amount of clout at City Hall? And as the Fed said, that his underlings are still lurking in the bowels of City Hall, which could encourage Judge Kendall to sort of, you know, give him a significant sentence to send a message to those people. But, you know, this is somebody who ruled City Hall with an iron fist and who really made no bones about somebody being willing to exercise power that if he wasn't placated on any number of issues, not just zoning matters, but issues that were in front of the Finance Committee. And this is somebody who ran every single city council meeting under Mayors Richard M. Daley and Rahm Emanuel nearly up until the end of his term. And, you know, if you're interested in sending a message, Ed Burke is the person to do it, because of course he always told people that he would leave the city council one of three ways: the jury box, the pine box, or the ballot box.
Yeah, I once asked Rahm early in his administration, because when he was on a cleanup corruption kick, why don't you get rid of Ed Burke? He gave me a look and he said, are you crazy? Do you have any idea how much political capital? I wouldn't get anything else done for 4 years.
Greg, I want you to talk about, well, the one place that Burke will not be going is Stateville, which is just north of Joliet. Tell us about the governor's plan to demolish that prison.
Well, Stateville is like something out of a movie, literally, and it's been in movies. It's old.
It's very, very depressing.
It's like something you could find in Germany where Count Dracula would be hanging out, almost. It needs to, we have better ways to deal with prisoners now, both to keep them secure and to promote turning around their lives. So Pritzker wants to tear the thing down and build a new one up to modern standards. You know, we don't, in this culture, we don't keep anything for very long. Things get outmoded, we make changes. Well, that's true in prisons as anything else.
Who's opposing the closing?
Oh, I think there's some concerns locally about are there going to be as many people? Are there going to be as many guards or whatever? Maybe you ought to spend the money on something else. But anybody who's been there, as you have, knows that this is an antiquated facility, to put it gently.
Salem, we are coming up on the second anniversary of the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, which basically overturned Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. In Illinois, Planned Parenthood has talked about how many out-of-state patients have come. I believe it's a quarter compared to 3 to 5% pre-Dobbs. Talk about how the Midwest has really become the safe haven for reproductive rights.
Well, I think we're seeing that Illinois itself and people who believe in reproductive health care here in Illinois need to do everything that they can to support all of the states around us. At the same time that was happening, Planned Parenthood had a drop in donor funds, lost some funding over the course of the last 5 years, and they were in danger of closing a couple of the clinics downstate. And so especially in that area where we border Missouri, especially in all of the areas where we border Indiana, we're seeing an influx of people coming in from those states looking specifically for healthy women care. In a city of Chicago, we think that we're in a bubble, but we know that there are currently no active health clinics that are concerned with healthy women care, doulas and midwifery. There's one that will be opening up in 2025, the Southside Women's Healthcare Clinic. So it's definitely a priority for everybody who is interested in keeping the rights that we have here to support those that don't.
And sticking to reproductive rights, Senate Republicans blocked Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth's bill to protect in vitro fertilization. Can you get us up to speed on what that vote was and her legislation?
So Duckworth has been trying to champion what's being called the Right to IVF bill, which is very interesting this week, especially when we saw that the Southern Baptists voted together to oppose the use of IVF. I think it's really interesting that we're having this conversation ahead of the two big conventions this year, too. So this is probably the first thing that's made me interested in hearing what speeches are going to happen at the RNC, because I think we're going to see a lot of rhetoric around bringing over the course of that organization towards the anti-IVF policies.
And you know, speaking of the DNC convention, what do you think? Do you think they're going to be protesters here for that? What do you anticipate?
Well, I think everyone is in the know that there's going to be a large group of various organizations coming down to Chicago for the entire month of August, and the city seems to be gearing up towards that as well. But there's a lot of people who have things to say to not just the DNC, but to Biden and all of the delegates who are going to be coming in. We're at the Reader. We're really concerned with what that looks like in terms of the city's take on public safety in general. You know, how does that coincide with what we know right now about what the city is doing for curfews and teenagers on the street?
So you're maybe anticipating some clashes?
I think that's safe to say, right?
I should get out my old gas mask, which I inherited from another reporter from 68.
Wow. And Heather, City Council has been dealing with issues around this quiet zone ordinance. What are the details?
Well, there's an abortion clinic in the West Loop that has become a target for anti-abortion protesters, and not only are they sort of have a sort of a tactics of confronting people sort of entering attempting to enter the clinic to get care, but they've also used sort of voice amplification systems to make it impossible for people inside the clinic to communicate with each other. So Alderman Bill Conway of the 34th Ward, he introduced a measure that treats this clinic like other hospitals in Chicago, which are surrounded by what the city's code calls quiet zones. Like, you can't use amplified systems for voices or for music, and it's essentially designed to not disturb the people who are very sick and getting care. So that the ordinance that passed this week would essentially treat this clinic like any other major healthcare facility in Chicago, and it passed with more than 40 votes. There is not much that 40 older people agree on, but they agreed on this, even though it took an hour of debate led by some of the most conservative older people on the city council, including Alderman Jim Gardner, who characterized this as an anti-Christian attack, which I thought was somewhat startling because, of course, this is essentially a viewpoint neutral ordinance. It is designed to prevent amplified sound from interfering with health care obtained by not just women, but people sort of needing any sort of reproductive health care. And it was a really tense debate that I think got sort of really off track, but, you know, it only got 4 no votes. And I think that in a city as Democratic as Chicago, I think that this is potentially an issue that you're going to see perhaps, you know, come up again and again, where, you know, the politics around abortion has changed significantly in the past year. And the fact that there were 4 alder people who sort of got up and said, you know, I think this is an inappropriate restriction on speech, I think was startling for a lot of people during that city council meeting.
You know, even Greg's favorite, we're both like, whoa, Jim Gardner said what?
Well, what I find interesting here is I want to combine these two issues we were just talking about, abortion and protests at the Democratic National Committee. There's a clear standard here that ought to apply universally regardless of your politics, and that is, do you have a right to protest? Yes. Do you have a right to express your viewpoint, good, bad, or neutral, on whatever you want to? Absolutely. Do you have a right, though, to do it in such a way that you're preventing people from going about their business? No. That's the standard that has been applied to the abortion clinics. That ought to be the same standard that applies for the convention. Lots of protests, but can they be so loud and obnoxious that delegates can't go about with their business? No.
Yeah. Salem, what do you think about that?
I'm hoping that won't be an issue at a place like United Center, where the sound is pretty good. But I do agree that this is an opportunity for us to look at what our rights are in terms of public expression, right? And also, just being a native Chicagoan, that clinic on Washington has been there ever since I can remember.
It's the one you can see right from the Kennedy. Is
right.
that the one?
Correct. Yeah. Which is why it gets so much attention, I think, from people of both sides of the issue.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think the protesters need legitimately say, hey, we want to be reasonably close to the convention center, not stuck off in Grant Park somewhere. Mm. I mean, it's a line, and you have to more than bow to people's legitimate American rights to protest.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of people gathering, let's talk about fun stuff like festivals. although we got news this week that Riot Fest is leaving the city. Salem, what are the details on that?
So after apparently going back and forth for a couple of months with the Park District, Riot Fest announced this week that they are moving their 3-day festival in September to SeatGeek Stadium in Bridgeview, which was a move that was anticipated a little bit behind the scenes. You know, I think a lot of the listeners can remember the immense debate that was happening over last year's Fest and before last year's Fest, especially with organizers in Douglas Park. And Riot Mike, Mike P., one of the main organizers of Riot Fest, did an interview actually with the Sun-Times this week. With Selena Fergassi, expressing some discontent with the experience that they had received in negotiating with the Park District, and explained that they just had to make a decision much more quickly, I would say, than it seems like the Park District was willing to put a stamp on things.
Yeah, and it wasn't a total surprise, although it happening so quickly and where it went, I think, was. But let's hear from the Park District, Rosa Escanero.
This was a business decision by the organizers. We have been working really closely with all of the community, the organizers, as recently as a couple of weeks ago. And so today's decision that we learned of late last night is a surprise to us as well.
You know, when It's been interesting to hear, like, residents and then different, like, who speaks for the community, because some people have said, this is great. It's showcasing the West Side. We, you know, are ignored with the city, and here's opportunity for jobs. And then there are people who are like, I don't want this in my community. And for me, it makes me wonder who gets to make these decisions. And again, who speaks for the community, because often people who don't like something are the loudest. But Salem, what have you thought about the debate and the pushback?
Well, if, I mean, for anyone who was in Chicago while Riot Fest was in Humboldt Park, we can see the exact same arguments happening years later. And I think that one of the good things that the organization did this time is that they've vowed to keep their promises in terms of the community organizing activities that they have promised for Douglas Park throughout the year. They did reroute a lot of the money that they make out of their charitable organization last year to different community groups in that area. So that's a good thing. On the other hand, though, it brings up kind of a larger debate, and this is connected to public expression, as we were just talking about who gets to be loud in public, who gets to decide what music we play together in public, who gets to decide what our biggest public festivals are. And in our city, we've often pinned that on places like the Park District, which is supposed to represent all of the people's needs and interests. So so I think there's going to be a lot more of these huge commercial festivals, which is, this is the shame part, I think, that comes out of this. A place like Lollapalooza, working in conjunction with a multi-corp like Live Nation, making some arrangement with city administration. And then we get that festival for 10 years. And my hope is that this also gives a little bit more oomph to community organizers in all of the neighborhoods that are already doing their own festivals and block parties, and people kind of gather around. And maybe in a COVID you know, society, smaller festivals are the way to go anyway.
Well, this move to Bridgeview means that the Chicago Red Stars women's soccer team will have to find another venue for September 21st. What kind of message does that send, Heather?
Well, you know, I am not a huge soccer fan, women's or otherwise, but it sends, I think, a message that women's sports is essentially displaceable. And you cannot imagine sort of Soldier Field telling the Bears, whoops, sorry, Taylor Swift wants to come and take over Soldier Field, so you'll have to find somewhere else to play the Packers, right? And it's especially, I think, poorly timed because the Red Stars just had a huge crowd come to see them at Wrigley Field, and I think indicates that if, you know, properly marketed and if you give people the possibility, people want to see the Red Stars play, and to make it sound otherwise, I think, is wrong.
Well, we like to end on good news when we can, and we've got some rare good news in the media world. The Chicago Reader is back to printing a weekly edition. It's been every other week since June 2020. Salem, quickly tell us what that means for the paper, the staff, the community of readers.
We were looking to come back to kind of a secure cadence that we've had since the beginning, since the 70s. And in the last couple of years, when we've seen a lot of newsrooms like ours just fold completely and disappear, we're so happy that our readers have stepped up and become members of our organization and helped us to keep the presses going.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Meha Ahmad and mixed by Max Lubers. The news can be a lot to handle, but our weekly news recap gives us the chance to catch up on the most important stories. If you enjoy our recap as much as we do, please consider leaving us a rating. It helps more people find us. I'm Natalie Moore, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.